Information about Cebu Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the Food Show. Today, talking to B. Wilson, author of Consider the Fork and How We Eat.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. On this episode of the Food Show, we're going to dig into the archives. One of my favorite interviews here at KBOO was with B. Wilson, author of Consider the Fork and First Bite. I talked to her when First Bite had just come out, and it was a fascinating conversation about how we learn to eat, both as children and as adults. Here's an excerpt of that interview with B. Wilson.
Why is it that some of us have this tortured, miserable, difficult relationship with food in so many different ways? And why is it that some of us actually find the whole process of eating quite easy, as I do now? I eat without guilt.
Yeah, it does feel like one part guidebook for, you know, an expecting parent, and then another part like this sort of resource to get perspective on your own individual eating and experience.
I really hope so. I wanted it to be equally useful both for parents and for people who are looking at their own eating habits. And after all, we've all been children once, so that I'm hoping also the parenting aspect would interest people even who don't have kids, because you can just think back and think, huh, when I was a baby, I was being exposed to these flavors, and maybe that's why I still gravitate towards these flavors.
And so you talk about the impact of learning to eat. It begins very early on. And so you describe an age range where we're most impacted by new foods and flavors. When do we learn the most about eating habits and food?
Well, probably in the first 2 years of life. So part of the reason that most of us don't think of our eating habits as learnt is that so much of the learning happens very early on when we're not conscious of it. So by the time we're aware that we've got preferences, we just think they're this innate part of ourselves. But the science, and this has been backed up by numerous studies, shows that you actually, most of these tastes for specific foods, they're a function of exposure, they're a function of memory. But a lot of the memories, they might even be happening in utero. Depending on what a mother's diet consists of, we know that amniotic fluid can taste incredibly garlicky if a mother eats lots of garlic. There was another study done where the mothers drank a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy. Their babies had this really positive experience eating carrot-flavoured cereal, and they preferred it over plain cereal. And that's months later. That shows that we can be sort of imprinted with these early flavour memories. But there's another period, the period between 4 months and 7 months in a baby's life. Psychologists refer to this as a flavour window, and it seems that this is a period when human beings are possibly more open-minded about new flavours than they ever will be again. And so the advice that we're given from the World Health Organization that you should do exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months, well, great for the mothers who are doing exclusive breastfeeding, but we know that because of patterns of work, and in the UK, it's something like only 1% of mothers are still doing exclusive breastfeeding. In the US, it's slightly more, but I think it's definitely far in the minority, maybe 10%. So actually what's happening is that those babies are being exposed to formula milk rather than breast milk. It would be much better if they could, at that age, be being given a taste of a range of different vegetables, not for the sake of they need the vegetables for nutrition, but just to give them a sense of this whole world of flavor.
So you talk about this idea that it doesn't take a single taste, that it takes sort of repeated exposure. Can you tell us about the idea of tiny tastes and how repeated encounters with novel foods build taste tolerance?
Yeah. So lots of parents are familiar with this idea that you're only going to get a kid to like a food if they try it multiple times. Sometimes people say 15 times, sometimes 10. Actually, there is no exact number. And it seems that once you've persuaded a child to like a few different foods, you get in a virtuous circle kind of situation, and it probably won't take as many attempts. But in response to that, loads of parents would say, well, how do I expose my child to broccoli when they don't want to eat it even once? Maybe they're gagging and spitting and crying at the thought of putting it in their mouth. So this new concept, tiny tastes, is really revolutionary. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds really too simple, almost. And I thought this when I first came across it. But it's had amazing results, both working clinics with kids who are on the really extreme end of the selective eating spectrum, a lot of whom are autistic, some of whom are down to eating just two or three foods like hot dogs, grilled cheese sandwiches, and are having to be fed by tube. The concept is, if the food being tasted is as small as a grain of rice, suddenly the pressure on the child is massively reduced and they can put it in their mouth because it doesn't have the sort of same texture. I mean, if we imagine what it would be like if someone said, will you put this slug in your mouth? You probably don't want to. But just maybe if it was, you know, really tiny, smaller than a spoonful, smaller than a forkful, so small you could barely register it was there, you just might put it in your mouth. And what these studies have shown is that if you can get a child to have a tiny taste, whatever the food might be, 10 successive days, 14 successive days, the dislike will probably change to like. And I did it with my own youngest child, and I was amazed. It converted him to eggplant, to cabbage, to all of these things I thought he'd never like. And it's not that he's by any means a perfect eater. I don't think any of us is. And he can still be reduced to tears at dinner time. But he'll sometimes now say to me things like, well, I like omelette. I really don't like soft-boiled eggs, but one day I might do tiny tastes with soft-boiled eggs and then I would like them. And to me, that's great that he's already somehow taken control of his own tastes.
He's bought into that system.
Yeah, he has. But it's somehow that shows to me it's not something I've imposed on him. It's completely the opposite of a parent saying, I want you to eat this, you should eat this. It's about changing your own desires.
So part of what you're describing is to sort of take the pressure off the eating experience. And so what I want to know more about is this sort of creating this stress-free environment. I mean, a lot of us have encountered the like clean plate idea, the sort of table battle where you have to finish everything mm-hmm. that's in front of you. You can't leave unless you do. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you have any advice for the feeder, for the people who are making the food decisions, how to create a stress-free eating environment.
It's easier said than done, as with all these things, because as a parent, I'm like this myself. it's the end of a difficult day, you've rushed home, you've desperately somehow cobbled together the ingredients to make something vaguely nourishing, and then to have it rejected is one of the most fury-making feelings, and you're thinking, the waste, can't they just eat it? Can't it just be simple? And it's very hard not to let your emotions get the better of you in that situation. But yeah, if somehow you can see that the end game is to get to the point where everyone at the table is actually enjoying food, and if everyone can just relax a bit, what we know about these exposures, they definitely don't work if there's any sense of unpleasantness or pressure, or immediately the experience then becomes aversive. So it doesn't matter how many times you're putting broccoli in your mouth, if you feel that you're being forced or coerced, that will just have the opposite effect. It'll put you off broccoli for life. So as far as you can as a parent, yeah, stop beating yourself up. Get rid of guilt. Stop talking about good and bad foods and just think, you know, food should be a joy. The aim is to get to the point where it's a pleasure, both for you and for the child.
So I can think back to growing up and remember vividly food memories. And I want to ask about the power of food memories.
Food memories are incredibly powerful. I mean, I would go so far as to say that memory shapes all of our food yearnings. I have a few stories in the book about prisoners of war and how acute their desire for certain foods became that reminded them of home. And these American prisoners of war in Japan who were constructing these elaborate feasts for Thanksgiving dinners that they would never actually eat, consisting of kind of multiple courses of turkey and ham and every kind of stuffing and cranberry sauce and 10 different kinds of pie. And there's something really poignant about this, thinking that the memory just has this force and it was something that they could share. And I think to some extent, we're all like that. One of the biggest problems with the way that we eat now is that so many of our feelings about foods that aren't going to do us good, you know, industrialized, cynically marketed foods, heavy in salt, sugar and fat, those are bound up in our mind with all of these memories that are good and true and pure to do with family and home and security. So it's really hard for people to give these foods up or cut down on them without a sense of loss.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. That was the first half of an interview with Bea Wilson, author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. We'll continue with that interview in a moment, but here are some of the news we are following at The Food Show. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and Health and Human Services released the newest dietary guidelines at the beginning of January. In general, they are similar to previous guidelines with a few changes. One improvement is that they focus more on lifestyle and eating patterns as opposed to specific nutrients and food groups. They take into account the benefits of a diverse diet. The new guidelines also suggest that Americans limit their sugar intake to less than 10% of their daily consumption. That means that the average American needs to cut their sugar intake nearly in half. The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee also recommended that USDA and HHS include sustainability as a factor when making healthy food choices. Unfortunately, that addition to the guidelines was too contentious, and USDA and HHS left it out when the dietary guidelines were released. Also, instead of calling out specific foods that contribute to an unhealthy diet, such as high in sugar sodas and beverages and junk foods, the guidelines lump these foods into larger categories. The lack of specificity is in large part due to industry pressure. The pending Dow-DuPont merger could have huge effects on the American agriculture and food systems. Currently, Dow and DuPont are part of the Big Six of seed companies, also including Monsanto, BASF, Bayer, and Syngenta. The merger would mean that already small list would be reduced to 5 companies, consolidating the power of the seed and chemical industry. Not only would the merger eliminate jobs via corporate streamlining, but research and development following the merger would take a big step back, meaning farmers of primarily corn and soybeans would have even fewer options for purchasing seeds. In an age when climate change is creating a range of regional challenges for farmers, access to fewer varieties of seeds will make growing food that much more difficult. The goal of the merger is to produce short-term profits for the shareholders of the two companies by streamlining and selling off shared assets. Those short-term profits will have long-term effects on the food system. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is creating a pilot project to blind test for GMOs in organic products. The testing project was created at the request of organic growers in California. CDFA will be testing samples on a number of raw agricultural products with known risks for GMOs, including alfalfa, canola, corn, soy, zucchini, summer squash, cattle feed, and seeds. The goal is to expand the list at the end of the pilot project. Since this is a blind test, the results collected from testing will be aggregated without identifying individual farms and farmers. This is a small step in monitoring GMOs and shows that growers as well as many consumers believe this is an important issue facing sustainable agriculture and our food system. GMOs are currently prohibited from organic products by federal organic standards. These are some of the food news stories we're following. You can find details on these stories on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. Now, back to the interview with Bea Wilson, author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. You talk about the idea that all the food we eat is essentially children's food, since what and how we eat when we're young has such an impact on what and how we eat when we're older. So how should we approach the idea of children's food?
Yeah, so this was another thing which I hadn't thought of before, that if actually eating is something we learn, then children's food is the food that we learn with. So it's really not a great idea to be feeding them this strange version of cuisine which has been invented over the past couple of decades of kids' food, which seems to be the least nutritious food of all, highly sugary cereals, very few vegetables, loads of French fries. And there has been a bit of a backlash against it, and Michelle Obama's done some great work. Really, the concept of children's food, yes, in the early months of the first 2 years, children may need a modified diet. Obviously, they don't have the same capabilities of chewing that adults do at first, and they mustn't have anything with salt for the first year, and there's various things like that. But as soon as possible, to just see that children aren't these separate species like pets. They just need food. They need good, regular food like the rest of us. And sure, they're not going to have the same wide range of tastes that most adults do at first, because they haven't been exposed to such a wide range of flavors. But the fact that they reject broccoli or kale or carrots on the first bite doesn't mean they're not going to like it. It just means they haven't tried it enough times.
In the book, you talk about the idea of hunger, which in my mind has always been pretty simple. If you're hungry, that's you're experiencing hunger. But you describe that it's not as it's much more complicated than you would are led to believe. And so how do you determine hunger?
It's really hard. And a lot of it is cognitive. It's going on in the brain. We think we should just be able to recognize hunger. As you say, I thought this as well. I thought hunger is just one of those things. It's got to be instinctive, almost just like breathing. And far from it. I mean, hunger management, almost more even than becoming omnivorous about food, is one of the biggest problems that people have with eating. I know it was my problem. And it's a really difficult skill to learn, partly because we know that we're taking our cues about when to stop eating from so many external forces around us. If we've been taught by our parents, as many of us still are, leave a clean plate, and the plate is so much bigger, well, you could just be doing exactly what seems like the rational thing to do, and yet you're eating a portion which is vast and way more than you need. It also seems that there are these strange emotional elements to hunger, above and beyond. You know, scientists have tried to look into various biomarkers. There are various hormones you can identify which seem connected with hunger, but none of them gives you an absolute measure. And then there are these weird things where scientists got people to drink a glass of apple juice and say, are you hungry or full? And didn't fill them up. But when they heated the apple juice up and called it apple soup, the subjects were actually full an hour later, which shows, you know, a lot of hunger is actually to do with what do we think we're going to be satisfied by. And the problem with diet foods is often that people don't believe they will be satisfied by quinoa or a salad or whatever it might be, because they've put this food in a category marked diet and austerity, and it's like the opposite of pleasure. And actually training yourself to think these foods can be satisfying too is a big thing.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that stood out to me was a study with a man who had short-term memory loss, and they managed to get him to eat three meals, convincing him that it was time to eat before he said he felt. I don't think he said that it was. He said he felt off.
Yes,
and that he couldn't
eat
because
of that
reason.
Wrong, but he still wasn't saying that he was full. Mm-hmm. I mean, which, and I think actually a lot of us are kind of like that. We don't have short-term memory loss, but we're constantly being pushed food from outside, which is kind of, and we should be saying, no, it's not lunchtime yet, or I don't need that. And it's very, very hard to say no when you're just sort of trying to go out to buy a newspaper and suddenly there are all these candy bars and it's as if they're speaking to you in some way. Hunger is really, really complicated. And also hunger in the developing world, I hadn't realized the extent to which that has a cultural element. Because this line that people often come out with about, well, we're so lucky in the States or Britain, the affluent West, we wouldn't have all these rarefied problems with food if we were properly hungry. You know, we wouldn't be anxious, there wouldn't be fussy eating, there wouldn't be anorexia. These are all problems of lucky societies. I don't think that's a very effective argument, because people are made deeply unhappy by these states, so therefore it is worth attempting to ameliorate them. Secondly, even if you look in the developing world, in communities where they're living with extreme hunger, hunger is still nuanced and complex. So there's this amazing food called plum peanut, made of peanuts, which has changed the treatment of child hunger. And in Africa, it's been a huge success, saved thousands of lives. It's like a kind of supercharged peanut butter mixed with vitamins and various other things. And the child just squeezes it direct in their mouth. And there's no risk of the kind of hygiene issues there used to be with some of the other foods that used to get given out where mothers had to prepare them in the home. But in Bangladesh, when aid workers go in and offer the same food, the parents will often say, that doesn't look like food to me. I don't think it will satisfy my child's hunger. I think it's making them ill. And what this shows is, wherever you are in the world, whatever your state, hunger can't just be satisfied by any old thing. It's a very concrete thing. You know, we need to know what it was we were hungry for. And sometimes the thing we were hungry for wasn't food at all. It was love. It was security.
You talk about, or you cite in the book, that up until the age of three, a child can self-regulate hunger, meaning they stop eating when they become full. How could we maintain this ability beyond the age of three?
It's very difficult to maintain it. This was a really interesting thing. I definitely didn't know this before doing the research, and it seems to cut across cultures. There have been studies done in China, some done in the States, that the ones in the States, you give a three-year-old or two-year-old child a portion of macaroni cheese, and if it's too big, they'll just eat less. If it's the right size, they'll eat the right amount. If it's too small, well, they'll eat all of it, and that's all there is. But they just seem to have this magical ability to know how much their body needs. And if you give the same different portions to four-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds, suddenly they're eating more in response to the bigger portion. Or some people, which is kind of interesting, get put off by the big portion and eat less. Those are people who are probably on the picky eating spectrum. How do you maintain it? Well, I think as with lots of these things, you have to recognize it is a skill and you can relearn it. There was a study done by a pediatrician called Susan Johnson, and she went into a preschool for 6 weeks and taught the kids how to recognize their own hunger using dolls. And these dolls had kind of fake stomachs filled with varying amounts of salt. And so the children could put their hand on the doll's stomach and say, that one is full, that one's half full, that one's empty. And then they'd put their hands on their own stomach at snack time and compare it. And by the end of the 6 weeks, they were starting to say things like, I'm quite full, so I'm not going to eat anymore. And that's a great skill to be able to learn. And lots of us as adults still haven't mastered that one.
So you have a chapter on siblings, and it got me thinking about growing up with a sister. I just wonder how siblings shape the process of learning to eat.
They hugely shape it. And it's one of these many things where what my book is trying to do is say, we all recognize that there are problems with the way we eat, but we're not actually looking often at the psychological factors that go into why we're eating like that. And yeah, siblings make a huge impact on what you eat, how you eat, how much you eat. And I mean, everyone has these different stories, if they've got a sibling, to tell of sibling rivalry through food. And I've spoken to people who really looked up to an older sibling and copied them. I spoke to one woman, I didn't put this anecdote in the book in the end, who loved her older sister so much, and her older sister had a really strange, picky relationship with food. So she tried to copy her and also not eat food, even though she could tell that actually she was enjoying it. And it was only when she grew up and left home that she thought, huh, those are not actually my tastes, I was just borrowing them. And in my case, as I've already said, I think I was definitely reacting against my sister. She had a rabbit, I had a guinea pig, she starved, I binged. There was more to it than that, but it's amazing the extent to which you need to define yourself in a family through food, and whatever way you find to do that. And my own kids, yeah, there's endless arguments about who's finished this, or that thing of when you have a pizza or a cake and it's you cut and I will choose. But it's almost like one of those prisoner's dilemmas. You don't trust the other person to give you the fair slice.
And I imagine that you have these relationships with food and with family, and that they have great impacts on them when you get older and how you see food.
Yeah, as with so much of what's learnt in childhood, these things stay with us. So you may no longer be sitting next to your sibling with your spoons laid on the table side by side, but your responses to food are still being formed by that person. And one of the ways that this plays out is through gender. And this is obviously not in every family, thankfully, but it's amazing the extent to which, even in this day and age, we are feeding boys and girls differently. And we're often feeding them in exactly the way that goes against their nutritional requirements. So with boys, there's strong evidence that across the world, parents have this view that boys don't need as much healthy food and that they need manly food, red meat. And we don't therefore push them to eat vegetables as much. And this is a real problem. You know, most people are not eating enough vegetables, so it affects girls as well, but boys are especially not eating enough. So it doesn't really serve them very well to say, oh, you're so manly, you don't need salad. And then with girls, conversely, the biggest nutritional need that they have growing up is for iron. Suddenly their iron needs jump from 8 milligrams to 15 milligrams during puberty. So to be saying to girls that they don't need this kind of hearty man food is absolute nonsense. And the idea that they could somehow subsist on lettuce leaves and chocolate and compliments, it's not very helpful. And there are also signs that, again, not all families, but in some families, enough that it can be measured statistically. There was a big, large-scale study of several thousand families in Minnesota who were studied over several years, proper longitudinal study, that showed that as girls got older, parents would put more pressure on them to lose weight, which is extremely counterproductive. When you pressurize someone to lose weight, it usually backfires and they actually gain weight. It also creates a horrible atmosphere at the dinner table. It doesn't make these girls feel good about themselves. Whereas with boys, the parents were backing off.
I want to finish with looking ahead. What does an ideal future look like where children grow up to be well-adjusted eaters?
Well, the first thing to say is it's entirely possible that it can happen. I felt really optimistic at the end of writing this book, because if food habits are learnt, the great thing is that they can be relearned, sometimes in quite a short period of time. What would it look like? One of the positive models I came across was Finland, where about 10 years ago, they noticed they had really bad rates of child obesity compared to their neighbours in the rest of Scandinavia. And they decided to do something about it. And they transformed their preschool education system to make learning about food, not healthy lectures, but sensory learning about food through play. You know, they'll have sessions with sweet, sour, salty, bitter, or where they taste different kinds of berries, or where they go exploring, or where they cook together. In a very non-judgmental, just open-minded, just enhancing their palate kind of way. And this seems to have already had beneficial results. The kids will come home and say to their parents, can you please buy this strange new vegetable? I tasted it at nursery. It was great. That to me would be a pretty hopeful kind of model. But the other thing to say is, you know, we focus so much on children sometimes, we forget how awful it can be to be an adult who, you know, is trapped in whatever form of disordered eating, whether it's bulimia, whether it's anorexia, whether it's adult picky eating. And that can feel incredibly lonely and quite hopeless. And the other thing that writing the book taught me is we don't need to be fatalistic. Yes, it's really hard to change your eating habits. No one should underestimate that. It's not going to happen with some short-lived January diet. That won't cut it. We're in it for the long haul. But if we see the problem as being not forcing ourselves to eat foods we don't like, but actually changing our tastes, changing our habits and preferences, then it's possible.
Bea, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the KBOO Food Show. I want to thank Bea Wilson for being on the show. For the second half of the food show, we're going to hear from dietitian Melinda Himmelgarn on Food Sleuth Radio. And stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives at noon. Don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of December for another episode of the Food Show. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Himmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I am delighted to welcome my guest, Ms. Laura Shapiro. She is a culinary historian and James Beard award-winning food columnist and book author. She has written on every food topic from champagne to jello in her decades-long career, which includes a 16-year running column for Newsweek, features and reviews and essays in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Condé Nast Traveler, Gourmet, Gastronomica, Slate, and many others. She is also the author of several terrific books, including Perfection Salad, Women and Cooking at the Turn of the Century, Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America, Julia Child, and most recently, What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. Ms. Shapiro also co-curated an exhibition called Lunch Hour New York City, and she was featured in Michael Pollan's Netflix documentary series, Cooked. Welcome, Laura. It is a delight to have you with me.
Thank you very much.
You know, I was interested, you also, in addition to all of your other awards and accolades, you won an award from the National Women's Political Caucus. What did you win that for?
I was writing for Newsweek for many years, and Newsweek didn't do a huge amount on feminism and the women's movement, but occasionally there was a story, and it was right around the time of Susan Faludi's book on women and the women's movement, and all of the Anita Hill sessions on Congress, that whole awakening that the country seemed to go through about women at that moment. And I wrote a story on that, which won an award from the National Women's Political Caucus, which is great to have on my resume, even though it has nothing to do with food.
Exactly. I was intrigued, for sure. And actually, why don't we springboard from that and talk about What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. I discovered this book and dove into it, checking different chapters about the different women. And the one that I started with, maybe this is a bad habit because I never start at the beginning of books, but I stumbled on Helen Gurley Brown. And I remember her from, of course, the famous Cosmo magazine. And what I found most interesting about her was her, well, I immediately diagnosed her with an eating disorder, which she eventually recognizes that, yes, indeed, she has. But at the very end, you know, she's asked about feminism. And her famous feminist that she identifies, of course, is Gloria Steinem, who was always, you write, Helen's favorite feminist. And Gloria really wanted her to speak out and speak about her feminist inklings. And Helen Gurley Brown was reluctant to do that.
That's right. Helen Gurley Brown thought of herself as a feminist. And I don't know, depending how you define the term, she probably did suit some of it. She was certainly in favor of most of the things that most feminists talk about all the time in terms of equal pay, abortion, the whole deal. But she treasured for all her life this view of a woman's goal being to catch a man. The idea that to have a man in your life is always the most important thing. She thought women could do absolutely anything on earth, and she wanted them to do anything on earth, but if they did it without a man in their life, then it was pretty sad. And that kind of fealty to men ran through her whole life and had a tremendous effect on her whole sense of self and her body image, which was that she was determined to remain what she would have called young and sexy and attractive until her dying day. So at the time that she had this interview with Gloria Steinem, she was, you know, well past middle age, I would say, and weighed very little because she was certainly close to anorexia, if not full-fledged. But she loved talking to Gloria Steinem, and Gloria Steinem has a great ability to kind of see into people. She's a very perceptive person. She knew that there was a serious person inside that, you know, all the makeup and the wig and the fashion and all that. She knew there was a serious person in there. And in this interview, she said to Helen, she said, "Say something about yourself. Take yourself seriously. Tell me the most important, serious thing about you." And Helen Gurley Brown tried, and she hemmed and hawed. Finally, she said, "I'm skinny. I'm skinny."
Yeah. How sad. And how sad that she was. She prepared food in anorectic style. She prepared these elaborate breakfasts for her husband. She did not eat with him. They ate separately. And she ate Jell-O, a package of Jell-O for dessert, which she diluted. Rather than using the 4 cups of water to the box of Jell-O, she only used 1 cup of water. She topped it with a dollop of yogurt, and she called that heaven.
Yes, and that was diet Jell-O. Remember?
Yes, yes,
so
that's right.
Which was the key to this whole thing.
Yeah.
She loved these artificial sweeteners. She had an enormous sweet tooth. And I think that when she went off of her various diets, she did it by binging on sweets. I mean, it's a classic syndrome that you have seen a million times. And this, she had such a passion for artificial sweeteners. I don't know. To me, it seems so symbolic. It sort of says everything right there.
Just, yes.
You know the flavor of those things. It's that kind of chemical, acrid aftertaste. And I feel as though she went through her culinary life, anyway, with phony sweeteners, fake desserts, make-believe indulgences. And it's just kind of a symbol of the sadder part of her life.
Yeah. And it's also a snapshot, I think, of the time. So we were going through this revolutionary time, really, with women's liberation. We were being extremely conscious about the way we looked, especially in the office. There was a sexual revolution going on. And Helen Gurley Brown was really the voice of that era. And you explore that time and other times in women's lives. And I know I'm jumping around here, but I was also really fascinated by your work out of Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner, and an article that you wrote about cake mixes and how women were basically told that they didn't have time to cook from this food industry that wanted to sell us processed and packaged foods. But really, women knew how to cook. We really didn't need those products, but yet we were sold on them.
Yes, this is such an interesting moment, these years right after World War II. And, you know, the 50s is the most disparaged decade in American life in terms of food. Everybody makes fun of it. But the fact is, it's not that. It is not what we keep hearing. The fact is, it was a pretty good era for food in a lot of ways. The food industry was starting to make its way into people's houses, but they weren't there yet, and a lot of women were resisting. Because you're right, they just didn't need these packaged foods. All the advertising kept saying, "We'll do it faster. Leave the hard work to us. Don't cook that old-fashioned way with all the drudgery and spending hours in the kitchen. You know, you can open a box and be out and go to the PTA meeting and take care of your children, and you don't have to spend these horrible hours in the kitchen." So the only way they could really sell these products was to try to convince people that their lives would be so much better if they didn't cook. These were women who understood perfectly well that cooking was not a big deal. It was fine. They knew how to cook. They'd been doing it all their lives. And you have to remember, in the late 40s and the 50s, cooking, making a simple dinner, was easier than it had ever been for any civilization probably in the history of the world. I mean, this is a country where most people had running water. They had indoor plumbing. They had gas and electricity. they could go to markets where they would buy the chicken was already plucked and the vegetables were cleaned. It was not difficult to cook, and women knew that. And also, meals were much simpler than they had been. You were not having these multi-course events anymore. Meals were shorter and simpler, so it was no big deal to get a meal on the table, so the food industry had to advertise very hard and strong and consistently over a long time to get that message and drum it into people's heads. Eventually, they were pretty successful, and a lot of these packaged foods are obviously now part of our lives, but they haven't taken over. I think people still cook, and we're not cooking as much, obviously, as we did in earlier generations, but we haven't lost it. It's still, the supermarkets are full of real food, and people take it home and they cook it. This idea that America is a land where nobody steps into a kitchen, I think it's quite false.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And it's interesting, there was an interview that you did with Gourmet Magazine called, it was Gourmet Live, and you would receive 10 questions, and you talk about cooking as people having a yen to do it, and that you describe cooking as not a frill, but as a survival skill. And when I saw that you had referred to cooking that way, I thought, oh my gosh, we are kindred spirits. Because I remember with my own children, they're grown now, of course, but teaching them that it's just like learning how to swim. You need to learn how to feed yourself. These are indeed survival skills. And yet I grew up in the, I guess it was, when I'm trying to think when I took home economics in high school, it must have been in the early 70s. And I suffered with what you also describe, you know, these home economics courses, which were really ways that the food industry got us to use their products. I was so disappointed, I remember. We used like a hot cocoa mix, and we used a box to make pancakes. I thought we should be, you know, we should be making these things from scratch. And you also wisely state that if we're going to change the world, and I think it is possible and essential that we change quickly through food, that we get back to home economics in a way where we have intelligent home economics, where we teach people how to cook and appreciate where our food comes from.
Yes, I think there was nothing wrong with that original impulse on the part of the early home economists to just educate a generation of girls, and to give them credit, they thought boys should be educated too in the basic skills of cooking. And they said also, you know, keeping a household budget and principles of cleanliness and whatnot. But cooking was definitely part of it. And then that whole thing was kind of hijacked by the home economics movement. But it is a survival skill. And this yen to cook, I remember so strongly during the time that I was at Newsweek, I was the food writer. And so my office was always stacked with millions of cookbooks. And these younger people would come by. They were interns at Newsweek, or they had a beginning job there, and they had just gotten out of school or journalism school, and this was their first job. They had just moved to New York. So these were kids who had just gotten to New York, and they were having a great time and going out all the time. And now they were a little sick of it, and they used to, and they wanted to stay home, and they wanted to cook. And they would come into my office and look around and say, do you have anything that's just for a complete beginner, something that really just starts by teaching you to boil water? And I often did, because there are a number of those books around all the time. They had a yen to cook. They were tired of going out all the time. They were beyond their school years. They were starting to be, you know, real grown-ups. They wanted to have a life, and they wanted to do some cooking at home. And I think people have that. Mm-hmm. I think this eating out all the time or ordering out all the time, I don't think it comes naturally to all of us. I really don't.
Right. Well, there's something very rewarding about preparing food and feeding those that you love. And Michael Pollan touched on that in his series with in Netflix, in which you were a part. But I want to touch on that, because I think that we probably have listeners that are wondering, just as I am, do you have a favorite beginner cookbook?
There's one. I'm going to walk right over to my shelf and look at it now. This is, it's really beginner. It's by Marion Cunningham, and it's called Cooking with Children. And of course, it's very basic, so it's sort of, it's too beginning for an adult beginner. But you would look at that book, and you would see some early principles. Now, Marion Cunningham also wrote a book called Learning to Cook, and that would be for people more your listeners' age. And again, she just goes through these basic things. Marion Cunningham was the woman who, when the Fanny Farmer cookbook was brought back by Knopf after many years out of print, she was hired to be the new Fanny Farmer and to redo, to revise and bring up to date this great Bible of the American kitchen that many generations of women had learned on, and she did that. And in fact, her version of the Fanny Farmer cookbook is actually a very good basic cookbook. But in learning to cook, she herself was a cooking teacher for many years, and she just puts together a lot of the lessons that she knew how to give to beginning cooks. Another really good way to start is Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything, which isn't necessarily aimed at beginners, but it's kind of the first basic recipe you need for millions of things and a very good way to move into doing some cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these, I'm looking at the ones that are just on my shelf, and I haven't looked in bookstores for these recently at all. I'm sure there are new ones out there that are as good or better than these. People can find them. There are ways to do this.
Mm-hmm. I need to take one break, and let me remind our listeners that if you're just joining us, you are tuned into Food Sleuth Radio, where we are joined by Laura Shapiro, culinary historian and James Beard Award-winning food columnist. She is the author of multiple books. The one I have with me right now is titled What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. Before we jump back into this book, I want to just add my own observations with regard to the books that I feel especially kindred to. One is a book that my husband brought to the marriage, and it's a basic Betty Crocker cookbook with the red cover.
Yes.
You know, if you want to learn how to do just a basic cheese sauce, how to make a basic soup, you don't need to buy things in cans. It's very quick and very easy. I've often thought when I see people driving through the drive-through for these fast food restaurants that fast food is neither, and it's much quicker to do it at home. But we should jump into this book because we have limited time, and I was really intrigued by your work, and I want to know what led you to certainly write about food at the very start, but also, what led you to these six women out of so many women that you could have chosen?
Well, some of these women, I think of them as just kind of waiting in my filing cabinet for me to write about them. Barbara Pym, for instance, who's a British novelist whom I write about here. This is somebody whose books I started reading years ago, and I loved them. She's a unique, very funny sensibility, and the books are full of food. I just fell in love with them, and I've been kind of waiting for years for a chance to write about her, and because she is so food-oriented, when I got the idea for this book, I thought, oh, goody, at last I can write about Barbara Pym. So that was one of the great treats. Then there was Helen Gurley Brown, whom we talked about, and I had written an obituary of hers, and that got me thinking about her. So again, when the idea for this book came around, I thought, you know, there's Helen Gurley Brown. She was a serious sort of pathological dieter. That was a relationship with food that illuminates everything else in her life. She belongs in this book. So I kind of pulled them in that way. It was not that easy to find all the people because, you know, for a book like this, you need to know the history of their relationship with food over the years, which means there has to be a paper trail. They had to have written about it themselves in their diaries and memoirs and letters, or it had to be in other biographies of them. You need to get the information somewhere. And most people, if you're a 19th century woman writing a diary or writing letters, you don't normally write about food. These people wrote about the weather. They wrote about Aunt Sally coming to lunch, but they never said what they ate. So I had to eliminate a lot of possible people because there just was not a paper trail. And I don't know, let's see, Eleanor Roosevelt came to me because I knew about the FDR White House. I knew that when the Roosevelts were in the White House all those years, the food was famously terrible. Everybody wrote
right.
about it. But it was intriguing to me because Eleanor just didn't seem like the kind of person who didn't care about her guests. She was famous for being kind of warm and hospitable and welcoming people. And people used to say they would come to the White House and they were so nervous, but they would meet her and she would immediately put them at ease. I just couldn't see her as just kind of dismissing as unimportant the fact that people were just kind of pushing this food around on their plate and sending the plate back. Well, there were reasons why. The more I looked into it, the more I could see that her own relationship with food was very interesting. It was fraught with overtones to do with her past and her marriage and her feeling about life and the world. Everything was in there. So again, there was a story there that was just kind of waiting to come out. For each woman, there was just some little mystery about her that I wanted to dig out.
Mm-hmm. Well, the hardest one for me to read about was Eva Braun. And
yes, and she was certainly the hardest for me to write about, no question on that. And first of all, it was not easy to get the material because she left very little written record of her own life, and I had to work around it. I had to find out what was on the table. She's sitting there next to Hitler. What is being served to them? And I was able to find that, but I had to come to terms with the fact that I was writing about this really horrible person. I had never done that. I had never written about somebody that, you know, was just so appalling. And yet that was the unknowable thing about her that I wanted to get to. I thought, you know, if food will give me an insight into this awful person and this terrible relationship, maybe food really does have some power to tell us things, you know. So if food can get me closer to Eva Braun, maybe it really is a good way to look at the world. And I think I did learn some things, but it was not easy to do, believe me.
Yeah, it was difficult to read. It made the story of the starvation, the purposeful withholding of food from groups deemed unworthy, and in contrast, the rich spreads that were on the table. And as much as that chapter is about Eva, there's a lot about Hitler's eating habits, really disgusting foods that he ate. So that was challenging. And I think that that's what this book, why it's so powerful, is it does help us realize just how important food is in our lives today and our history and moving forward into our future.
Well, if it can open up some of those avenues of thought in the people who read it, I will be very, very happy. I do think that to look at the world through food is really enlightening and shows us a lot, really. And it was a great experience working on the book. Agony, writing is agony, but I learned a huge amount, I must say, doing it.
Is there anybody else of the six women that you would like to pull forth from this book? What did each of these women teach you?
Well, I learned something about the nature of class, really, from writing about Rosa Lewis, who was a caterer in Edwardian England, and she was born into a poor working-class family, a Cockney family, in 1867. She pulled herself up kind of by her own bootstraps. She became a scullery maid. That was her first job. And then little by little, she learned French cooking. It's not quite clear how. And she became one of the most sought-after caterers in London at a time when food was hugely important. Escoffier was kind of the leading cook of that time, and to be a caterer in those high, noble circles meant that you were cooking this elaborate French food. She turned that stuff out, and she really became a huge success and made quite a bit of money. And she used her new status to mingle with these upper-crust people, and that was extremely important to her. She loved that, but she clung to her Cockney accent. As you know about the British, accent is everything. Accent is the key to your class. It's your class identity, and anybody can place you on the class ladder from the way you talk. So even though Rosa Lewis might sweep into the drawing room and sit down and have a cup of tea with the lady of the house as soon as she opened her mouth, it was quite clear who she was, and she did that on purpose. She was living at a time when people were very accent conscious, and she could have gotten rid of that accent. There were ways, you know, you could do elocution and so forth and change your accent, as Eliza Doolittle does in My Fair Lady, which was right at that time. Rosa Lewis didn't have that. She wanted to be accepted as herself, so she wanted to both raise her class and also be accepted for her class. very, very interesting combination, and I have never read or known of a story like that. You hear a lot about changing class and leaving your class behind and so forth. She wanted it both ways, so it was terrifically interesting that way.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and so I am going to jump to the afterword of the book in which you describe your own food story and how fascinating that shortly after you were married, you moved to India. Do you have any remembrances from that time about the food environment that you want to share with our listeners?
We lived in a town that was a major pilgrimage site for worshippers of Krishna, people who followed the god Krishna. So it was a busy town, but they didn't have a lot of Westerners there. They had a number of Hare Krishnas from the West, but people like me that were not a lot of. There were not a lot of Western women going around riding bikes, for instance. So I didn't feel free to go out and do a kind of food travel the way so many of us would love to do. The food was wonderful, I gotta say. My own cooking was terrible, as I write in that afterward, but the food everywhere, even in this relatively small place, it was very traditional and certainly none of the really fancy, glamorous Indian restaurants that are in India now that people go to. Wasn't like that at all. You got very simple stuff, but the friends whose houses we ate at, it was just a beautiful home cooking of that time and place. Just these simple vegetable things. Everybody, of course, a vegetarian, and the simple local seasonal vegetables. I would go to the market and the women would be sitting on the ground and surrounded by just what they had brought in that day from some little plot of ground that they took care of somewhere. So there'd be some carrots and tomatoes and this and that, and I would try to speak Hindi in the market and stumble through my awkward request, you know, may I have 1/2 pound of tomatoes? They would smile and give it to me. Everything was delicious. Every simple thing, the tomatoes, of course, I had soaked them in this iodine solution, but even so, you could get some tomato flavor through that, and cooking them, they still tasted delicious. The yogurt, I still remember the yogurt. There was, I didn't know even that there was a category of food called yogurt that could taste like that. It was the real thing. In fact, the milkman, we would have to buy the milk and butter every day, and then, you know, the milk had come in from being milked. It was the real thing. Yeah. Somebody like me who grew up in a suburb, I had never seen food that came right out of the earth like that, right from the hand of farmers and milkmen. I had never seen that or tasted it before.
Well, we'll have to end our conversation with that, but I would like to close with the last line of your book, which says, I was starting to understand home cooking. The important word was home. And I think that if our listeners are interested at all in the magic of food, they should definitely visit much of your work, which is available on your website, which is simply www.laurashapirowriter.com. And you can get a sampling, a buffet of all of your great work. I want to close by thanking our listeners for joining us and remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn at KOPN Studios in beautiful downtown Columbia, Missouri. Thank you so much, Laura Shapiro, culinary historian, James Beard Award-winning food columnist and book author. And her latest book, which we just touched on, is titled What She Ate: 6 Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks very much.
Okay, that's the end of the food show. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO, KBOO Portland. It's just a couple minutes till noon. We have a couple of announcements to play, and then we got the KBOO Noon News coming your way, and also jazz. Jazz Marcia is here to bring you a great show this afternoon. And thanks for listening today.
Everybody's in the same holy boat. We got to have food.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export. On Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon, in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space in Portland. Untold Stories is Know Your City's second annual benefit gala, and it raises essential funds to further Know Your City's programs of engaging everyday Oregonians in the history, culture, and civics of the region. This year's gala will bring together over 150 guests for an unforgettable evening, including hors d'oeuvres, drinks, dessert, performances from local talent, and a paddle raise. Again, that's the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, Suite 200 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.